It is April 14th, 2023, and we are in the Princeton Public Library to hear an oral history for Voices of Princeton as part of a partner project with the Jewish Community Foundation of Greater Mercer. My name is Kim Dorman, and I'm facilitating with Lou Gantwerk, who is interviewing Ruth Shulman.
Hi, I'm Lou Gantwerk, and I'm here as part of the project, and I will be interviewing Ruth Shulman. Ruth?
Thank you so much for, I'm Ruth Shulman, and thank you so much for inviting me. I think this is a wonderful idea to that we not lose sight of our history as the decades go on. Yes.
So I'm going to start out asking you, how did you come to Princeton?
Okay, well, my husband and I, and at that time our two sons, we were living outside of New Brunswick in a wonderful, racially integrated co-op apartments. And I was very happy there and wanted to stay there. I said to my husband, when you hung clothes out on the line outside, it was an intellectual experience. I didn't want to leave, but there were two reasons we had to leave. One, my husband's job changed and he got a new job in Trenton, where his previous job had been in Edison. So it was a much longer commute from New Brunswick, and so we wanted to move closer to Trenton. And secondly, my firstborn son was in kindergarten in Franklin Township, where this was really located. And Franklin Township was turning down school budgets year after year, and my son was in kindergarten, and I thought he would be a school dropout in kindergarten, because they had too many classes of kindergartners and not enough classrooms, so they had to have their heads on their desk. And that wasn't who my son was. So we needed to find a place that was closer to Trenton and that was not turning down school budgets. We looked, now I knew one thing. We were not going to move to the suburbs. I was a quote, stay-at-home mom, which meant that I really didn't stay at home as much as many women did in those days. And I was not going to be a chauffeur who would have to drive my children to school or to any place. So we began looking at all sorts of places. Of course, Princeton was high on the list because it had desegregated its schools in 1948. And where we lived in Franklin Township outside of New Brunswick, we brought suit against our Board of Education to desegregate two of the elementary schools. So that Princeton had already done this, I thought, was just absolutely marvelous. Here was a community without problems, huh? But it was fine. And the kids could walk to school and everything was fine. We found that there was an integrated housing group in Princeton, but the houses were much too expensive. We couldn't afford them. And there was another integrated housing group out near Route 1, not in Princeton, but there I would have had to drive kids all over, and I wouldn't do that. So Princeton became a possibility, except we found a house on Franklin Avenue and Harrison. Now, you'll laugh at what we paid because it seems so ridiculous. This was 1964. And the house was $17,900. That meant you had to put 20% down, which was $3,400. Well, we were not Rockefeller. We didn't have that kind of money. But my husband had been in the Army of the Occupation after World War II. So he had the GI Bill, and we were white. So we were able to have an FHA inspector come. And he said, no, you only have to put down 10% on that house. So we moved into Princeton for $1,700 down. And it's true, my son walked to Littlebrook School. I was so happy. They could walk to the shopping center. They could walk to the Jewish center. They could walk to the library. I mean, that's what kids were supposed to do. They were supposed to be independent. And we only had one car, and my husband took that car to work. So that's how we found our way to Princeton.
Ruth, would you tell us your husband's name for the record?
Oh,
he's
yes.
going to be part of the story, I suspect.
My husband was Mel Shulman, who I called lovingly by his Hebrew name, Menachem Mendel the Magnificent.
So when you got here, it sounds from what you've said like it met some of your expectations. What was it what you expected, and what ways was it what you had hoped?
Yeah, it was what I expected, in that really Dan, who was like 5 and a half, really could get around by himself, and I felt confident in that. I started teaching at the Hebrew school. I had, in my earlier years before graduate school, I spent a year working on a kibbutz in Israel, so I was, not many people had done that, so they were very happy to have me teach in the Hebrew school. So what it didn't have was, it took us a while to develop a sense of community. So it was very nice. There were all these lovely stores. There were, you know, everything was very nice. But I didn't know anyone, you know, at that point. Teaching in the Hebrew school helped a lot because I got to know the kids, and therefore got to know the parents. So it was good. But nonetheless, we left a community. And I miss that very much. And I miss the fact that it wasn't integrated. Littlebrook School was all white. What I did was I became involved in some things like what the housing. I became a tester for housing. So, you know, people wanted to sell their house. They put an ad in Town Topics. And then so I would call up and I would say, hi, I see you have selling a house. And, you know, I have friends in New York. You know, I have friends in New York, forget it. Thank goodness they didn't ask for a name because I didn't know who the couple was. And I said, could, you know, it sounds wonderful. And my friends would love to have a place. And, you know, your child, their children would go to Riverside. It would be wonderful. And then I went over 3 days later with my friends from a black couple from Manhattan, and we pressed the doorbell, and she looked at me and she looked at this other couple and she said, I forgot to call you and tell you we've already sold the house. So you were a tester. So I said, what do you know?
What was that like for you, coming from an integrated?
You know, I couldn't believe it. Other stories like that, there was no swimming pool, there was no municipal pool. People came around and asked, and they were smart to ask, but it was a question that really hurt. If that pool is open to everyone in the community, blacks and whites, would you allow your children to go swimming there? I mean, that was an issue. When stores were going up, the laundromat, you know, would you use a laundromat if everybody used a laundromat? I mean, I'd never thought of these things. So in that sense, Princeton had a way to go, and I learned very quickly that Princeton had a way to go. But you could do things here. For example, there were atom bomb drills in the school. Now, fire drills, I understand. But if you're in Littlebrook, which is glass all around and a bomb drops, that the kids are standing in the hallway is not going to make any difference. So I went to the Board of Ed and I protested that, you know, if you want to keep the children safe, you have to really work on keeping atom bombs at a distance. And it's, you know, this only, it only makes kids anxious. And people listened, and they did away with tests like that. So it was a place where you could make some difference if you came and you had, you know, other things you wanted to see.
And your search for a community, it sounds like it started because you had a skill that other people didn't have, and you were welcomed to the Jewish Center as a teacher. Could you talk more about how that sense of community evolved for you, whether it was the degree to which it was formulated as a result of your interaction with the Jewish Center versus other organizations? How did that evolve for you?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, certainly the Jewish Center was a major part of it because I taught there for 9 years. What I loved about it was that, because this is a small town, it was in those days, so they'd see that I was their teacher, but if they went with their parents to the tennis court, they'd see their teacher was playing tennis. She was a real person. That was very nice. What I liked was Everett Gendler was our rabbi, and I went to him and I said to him, there are things in this curriculum that I'm not going to teach. I don't believe them. I think these are stories you give to kids and they have to unlearn later. And I don't want them to unlearn these things. And he was very responsive and said, well, if you feel that you can't teach them honestly, then you can't teach it. I don't want you to teach it in a way that wasn't. So I felt that my interest, what was important to me was being respected. We also joined other groups. We joined a co-op babysitting squad because at that time our daughter, Amy Adina, was born, so we had a baby as well. And so we got to know a lot of people from the co-op, and these were all kinds of people from all over, and they just had little kids. And you went there, and Mel was the one who would do the babysitting because he liked to go. The houses were clean. They always had, nosh for him to eat. And he met people. But I think it wasn't so much that I met people, but my husband was a people person. And he just, he would speak to you, and within 5 minutes, he would know your history and everything about you. And he enjoyed people. And so we always had people coming in and out of the house. So that to me was very important because the kids had to have playmates and they had to have friends. They had to come to the Jewish Center for Hebrew School. They had to walk there and walk back, and the kids were from all over. And so, and our friends from Franklin Township remained our friends. And they came down and they it's just up the road and, a half hour, so it's not so bad. So, that was fine. We really, I don't know other organizations that we belong to or joined. But, the kids and Mel were very athletic. Tennis was a big thing. Eve Kraft, oh my God, she was just spectacular in what she did with those kids. So they went to, they really learned how to play tennis. They were athletic, and Mel was athletic, and so it worked. So we met people who were, not only, focused on social issues, but on other issues as well. And then there were people who, Mel had a beautiful voice, and so he would do chant Haftorahs at the Jewish Center, and that's how we met. Lou and I met because Lou was directing a play by the river. Washington Crossing State Park, and he decided he needed Mel to be in the chorus, and so that's how things worked. It was just an easy melding. But not much contact on our part, because I don't know why, but I didn't do it, and just didn't have a lot of black friends, but I, kept the friends from Franklin Township, but not here. Anyway.
So it, just in keeping with this theme for a minute, and then we'll go on to other things. Have you seen that change in Princeton? What's your observation today as you look at the relationship between black and white people, Jews and black people, Jewish people and other white people? How do you see the whole racial sort of progress or lack thereof? What's your sense
of
that?
There is some progress, without a doubt. I think that's probably... In the time, that we see this all over now, that there's much more interest and involvement. I mean, I had no idea of how difficult it was for Black kids to go to that integrated school system here in Princeton. I mean, we had no contact. Our kids didn't have contact with Black kids. And so I don't know. I didn't have that. I think there's more of it now. Certainly we're aware of it. And when you're aware of it and there are groups that are working on that, that's very good. I don't think that I just didn't know enough. I didn't know enough as much as I thought I knew. So I'm hoping it's a little better now with the Paul Robeson Center and the whole, Witherspoon, John Street. But in those days, no contact.
So wondering if you're, we'd like to talk a little bit about formative experiences in Princeton. You had little kids when you moved here, and you were new to the community, and as was Mel. Are there specific memories or things that you remember as being formative, however you'd like to sort of define that notion that you could talk about?
I don't know formative experiences. When Amy went to nursery school, she went to Friends School down, I don't know where it is, outside of Princeton. And that was a very interesting thing to meet. Again, to meet different kinds of people. And so that was important to me. I was on the, for example, in the high school, the PTA, that sort of thing. So that we were working on making sure that there was adequate schooling for everybody and that budgets were passed. In fact, one of the things when we were considering Princeton, I came home one night to Mel before we moved here, and I said, Mel, you'll never believe it, but I went to a meeting of all of the candidates for the Board of Education, and they all support the budget. To me, that was unbelievable. So I was involved in the PTA and that sort of thing. But and as I say, with housing and but nothing.
Well, if you think about your children as they went through school, given that it wasn't, it had pluses and minuses again, are there experiences you remember that they had which were particularly important in their lives if they were here to be interviewed? What do you think they would talk about?
Well, they had really positive experiences. Mm-hmm. They didn't have any problems. Though I did go to Littlebrook School when Joel, my second son, my second child, was at Littlebrook in first or second grade. And I said to the teacher, he doesn't know how to read. He's reading to his baby sister, Father Bear Comes Home or something, one of those books. And he's not at all reading what's in the book. He doesn't know how to read. I would like you to test him. So they tested him with things that, material he didn't know, without pictures, without anything. And they said to me, you're right, he doesn't know how to read. And I said, what are you going to do about that? And they said, Mrs. Schulman, he's getting all A's. He'll be fine. Don't worry about him. And that was their answer. So I said, Joel, how are you getting A's in school if you can't read? He says, we work in a group. And he says, two of the kids do all the reading, and then they tell the rest of us. And I volunteer to do the oral report to the class, and I do the cover. I draw the cover of the report. And two other kids write it up, and we all get an A. So, I don't know what would have happened if he weren't a smart kid that way and could figure it out, but they did say that. I do remember one comment that one of the teachers made. We have some children from the blackest part of Trenton, and they're not doing well, and your son will be fine. And I thought, that's very strange to put it in those terms. I didn't like that. So they did well. They made friends. They tried to get when the university, you know, would have its, the end of the semester, the end of the year, they would all get together and they would try to, and you know, integrate themselves into that. They had a wonderful time. They would go every place on their own. And that, I think, was the thing that was most important to them. You wanted to go to the swimming pool? No problem. You know, you got on your bike and you just went over. I do remember that Dan, our oldest son, turned 16 or 17 and got his driver's license and came home and wanted to know where his car was. And we looked at him and said, where is your car? You finish high school, you go to college, you graduate, you'll get a job, you'll buy yourself a car. He put aside his bike, and after that he walked every place. He wouldn't be seen on a bike. So there were people in Princeton who had more money and who, you know, kids drove their cars to school, and my kids never did that. And either you became friendly with someone who picked you up or you walked.
So let me go back to Rabbi Gendler. People may not know who he was in the United States, certainly in Princeton.
Yeah.
And you had a particularly close relationship with him. So
personal,
could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Everett Gendler was the full-time rabbi who came the year before we did, in 1963. And I have been told, though I have never seen it, that there was a picture of the new rabbi coming to the Jewish Center in 1963, and he was behind bars in Selma, Alabama. And I've never seen that picture, but I thought, wow, this is a good place. I like this Jewish Center. Though when we were looking, I went to the Jewish Center and I thought it was like a community center. And I walked in and I said, where is the swimming pool? And Helen Schlaffer, who was the secretary, said to me, there's no swimming pool here. And I said, well, isn't this a Jewish community center? And she said, no, this is a synagogue. And I said, oh, I've never heard of a synagogue that didn't have a Hebrew name. So I had to learn. But Everett Gendler was wonderful. And the congregation, when they hired him, I don't know, you know, if they knew exactly how radical he was in those days. But he did things like, oh, I was just so amazed and so thrilled. He went into the high school, because there was the draft in those days, and this was the, you know, mid-60s, and it was the Vietnam War, and he went into the high school and spoke to the boys and told them that they did not have to register and go into the Army, that they could become conscientious objectors, and how they could do that. And he put a letter in the local newspaper about his opposition to the Vietnam War, and signed Rabbi Everett Gendler, and some people were very upset. And why should he say rabbi? And, you know, he said, well, of course, he's a rabbi. He can do that. He didn't say rabbi of the Jewish Center. He just said rabbi. But he did that. He also was very involved, and he had a president in those days, whose name I can't remember now, who was very involved in civil rights activities. And so there was a lot of work with civil rights activities and anti-war activities, and I was just thrilled. I was on the board of the Jewish Center. I guess that's another way I met people, because I was on the board of the center. And he asked, told us that he was going to leave and he was going to go down to Mexico and study with a socialist, whatever. And the board, even though he was this controversial rabbi, the board asked him if he would please take a leave of absence for a year and then come back. And he said no, he would not do that. He was just leaving. Mm-hmm. And we were very sad, but I was really very pleased that the board, despite all of Everett's activities, the board recognized him as someone who was very special, and we wanted to keep him as our rabbi. Mm-hmm. I consider him one of two rabbis that I have had here in Princeton who just changed my life, or encouraged me in changing my life.
Talk more about that.
The second rabbi was Herschel Matt. And Herschel Matt came in the 70s, and his goal when he came here was to make us an egalitarian congregation. Before that, women were not called up to the Torah. If a girl was 13, she could have a, quote, bat mitzvah on Friday night, but wasn't called up to the Torah. Later that was changed, and girls could have a bat mitzvah on Saturday morning, but they could not be called up for an aliyah.
Do you want to say whether an aliyah is just...
An aliyah is just a prayer before you start reading the Torah, and it has to be done, and it was only for males over the age of 13, and even if a girl was going to be... considered a bat mitzvah, she still couldn't be counted. You couldn't count women in a minyan, in a group that you need. You need 10 people to have a service, a minyan. You couldn't count an adult woman to be in a minyan if she had to say the prayer for someone who had died or whatever reason. Or you only had 9 males and you had a woman. She wasn't. Herschel Matt came and he changed all of that. And quickly, and people were threatening to leave the congregation. Oh, this is not what I want. No, this is terrible. You can't have one do this. And he educated us and helped us do that. And I think, because I've checked around and I've tried to find others, I think I was the first woman to have an aliyah with Mel, not by myself, but with my husband. And at the Jewish Center, and I think it was for my son's bar mitzvah. But so now if a Mel, you know, if I were divorced or if he had died or what, would they call me up as a woman by myself? I don't know. But at least I was the first woman to be called up. And Herschel Matt helped me learn how to wear a tallit, the prayer shawl. And I remember going into services the first time and thinking, I'm wearing a tallis, and, you know, the sky is going to open up and there's going to be thunder and lightning. I'm hoping no one will see it. But I was very careful. My tallis was a shawl from Landau's that I had done all the knots to make it legal. But I hope maybe no one would realize I was wearing a tallis rather than just a shawl. I mean, the days were very different then. But I'll tell you one thing about Herschel Matt. When my son Joel, my second son, was in college, he wanted to go to Brandeis Bardeen Institute one summer, and he needed a recommendation. And I called Herschel Matt, and I said, Herschel, will you give a recommendation for Joel? Because I knew that would do it. And he said to me, Ruth, I'll give a recommendation for the family, but I don't know Joel since his bar mitzvah. And I can't give a recommendation because I... And I thought to myself, that is the standard that I want to have for myself. He knows, and he could give any kind of recommendation, and it would be fine, but he wouldn't do it. And Joel got in anyway, and he says that was one of the important things in his life that he did. But both kids went to Hebrew school here and had their bar mitzvah. Even Amy, by that time, she certainly had her bat mitzvah here and all. And... it was a wonderful place for kids. They had friends who were Jewish, and they had friends who weren't Jewish, and they just, everybody paddled around.
Didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so you're not a person who has shied away from controversy.
Yeah, that's true. Sometimes very difficult, but yes.
And from what you've said, Princeton provided opportunities, school board, board of the Jewish Center, the housing authority, whatever, the things that you've mentioned. I'm wondering if there were other things that you could talk about related to your, I'll say, quote, political activism, unquote.
Yeah, I don't know where this started. I mean, I grew up in Albany, New York, and Albany, New York is what I call, in those days, a white bread town. It had, you know, I didn't see any black people. I didn't see any, it was just all white and it was boring and dull. So I don't know how this came to me. I think it probably happened when I was in Israel on the kibbutz and saw all different kinds of people and Israeli Arabs and everything. And so somehow or other I felt, first of all, the kibbutz was wonderful in that you didn't have to live in your own separate house and everyone have all their, you know, playground for their own kids and everything. You could share it. And that to me was wonderful. And I came back and never found that except in this, racially integrated co-op. There we did things together and that was wonderful. Those were the early 60s. Not only did we bring suit against the Board of Education to integrate the schools, but we picketed the draft board that because they were sending quote-unquote advisors to Vietnam. And I was very much against that. Again, the bombing, what was going to happen with these atomic bombs, what were we going to do? So I was very involved in a women's strike for peace. And I got more involved in just in women's movement and things of that sort. Mm-hmm. So, those were my friends. Now, when I came to the Jewish Center, I've had a bit of difficulty there because, I'm kind of left-wing. And that's true with Israel as well. And I felt that we should be able to talk about Israel and have all kinds of organizations and individuals talk about Israel, not just one particular point of view. And that was not always appreciated. And in fact, J Street started, which I found is a fascinating group. And there were a group of us in the New Jersey area that wanted to get together and talk. And we went to the Jewish Center board and I said, I went, Sherry Rosen went, a few others, that we would like to rent a room, not public, but just a room where a group of us from J Street could meet. And they said no. And then we said, no, what's the policy on renting a room? You know, we'll pay for it. We're not, and they didn't have a policy. So they formed a group to get a policy on to whom do you rent rooms and whom don't you rent rooms? And this committee met for weeks and weeks and they interviewed people and they gave a recommendation to the executive committee of the board. And the executive committee of the board turned it down. And the guy who I don't remember again his name, was the head of the committee, who is a faculty member at the university, he resigned from the committee. And I don't know that they ever have a policy of who can rent rooms, but J Street was not going to be one of those. And we even had Jeremy Ben-Ami speak here, I think. And the rabbi at that time, can't remember, was really not a good moderator and couldn't control the audience who was yelling and screaming and all of that. And then when Gil Gordon was president, it really, we had a lot of trouble. I made a recommendation at a board, at a general membership meeting in the spring, that we invite AIPAC and J Street and other types of groups, all kinds of groups, that we invite them to come and give a talk at the Jewish Center, that they be allowed to do that. And that was passed by the membership. It never came to be. The board decided that that's not what they wanted to do, and they brought in someone to help us learn how to talk to each other, which we couldn't do. And but the reality is that, in fact, there was someone who, it was just very painful for me. I would go to services every Shabbos. I mean, that's what I did. And there was someone there who was very involved in the center who would see me and who would just turn his head and walk in the other direction and would not. So I said to him once, look, why don't we have a cup of coffee and let's talk about what's going on here and all of that. And he wasn't interested. And I sent him an email before Yom Kippur. And I said, look, Yom Kippur is set up just for us. Please, let's have a cup of coffee and we'll talk and we'll get things straightened out or not. But I have to hear your point of view and I want you to hear my point of view. And we did. We had a cup of coffee thanks to Yom Kippur. And we nod at each other now and we say hello and all that. But it's not... So I don't know. There, it's a very difficult time. Now it's much worse. And I think our rabbi is doing a great job in bringing David Broza so that we can sing to celebrate Israel and we don't have to talk politics. Because I find it very upsetting now that we have nothing about Israel except once a month in the newsletter we have someone who talks about a poem or a song from Israel. That's very nice. Well, come on. To me, that's the worst thing is ignoring it. So anyway, right. Yeah, so I've had my ups and downs here, but that's okay.
So we may come back to that, but there's another piece of your history here that I know about, and that is the house you finally moved into.
Oh, so we lived in our first house at the corner of Franklin and Harrison until Amy Adina was born, and then we needed a new house, so we found a house. And by that time, that house for $17,900, we could sell for $25,000. We had money to buy a house that had three bedrooms. So we bought this house, and it was, you know, again, close to schools and the shopping center and the Jewish center. You always had to be able to walk every place, even though we got a second car by then because I went back to work. So you, what was your original question to me?
To tell us about the house.
The house. So the house was a very nice house. It had what was called a living room where you entered from the side and you went through the living room to get to your kitchen or to get to the bedrooms or the stairs upstairs. Or it was really just a hallway, the living room, and it was the dining room and it was, you know. And I thought to myself, you know, if we're going to have meetings here, and we did have meetings of all kinds in the house, I think I'd like a living room. And I don't remember how Mel tried to... Mel grew up in a very poor family. To him, to spend any kind of money was very difficult. And I don't know, he tried very hard to talk me out of it. But finally he said, well, if we're going to do it, then we have to have an architect do it. We just can't do it. And I guess he thought maybe that would be so expensive we wouldn't do it. So somehow or other we got in touch with Michael Graves, and he did this wonderful, put on this wonderful living room, but just changed the whole appearance of the house, the front appearance. And what I loved about it, Princeton is just wonderful. People would knock on the door, and who I didn't know, and they would tell me either they liked it or they didn't like it, that it wasn't in the Princeton style. I mean, you had to. You have to be just fine, thank you. The kids didn't like it. I remember once I got a call from the nurse that one of the kids was sick or something, and I was at work and I couldn't come home. And she said, well, I'll make sure he gets there. And I said, well, do you know where we live? And she said, of course I know your house. I mean, there weren't many like Michael Graves. Now it's just another house. But what we've done, I mean, my kids had a great education in Princeton, all of them. And I, having lived in Franklin Township and seeing what a lousy education is going to do to your kids, so I thought, we have done nothing for except live here in this. We moved into the one house because we were white and we were lucky. Oh, I have to tell you one thing about moving into that first house. We got it, the mortgage, for 10% down, $1,700. But the papers said that, and we had to sign it, that we agreed that if we would sell the house in the future, we would not sell to a member of the Negro race. And I said, what is this? And our lawyer said, don't worry, it's not enforceable. You can't, you can do what you want. I said, I don't want to sign this. You're going to have to redo these papers and take that out. I won't sign it. And they did that. So that was important to me. I just couldn't believe that in 1964 in Princeton that would happen. And so anyway, so we moved into that house, and because of that we were able to get this other house and afford it. And, you know, except for putting on this Michael Graves addition, I mean, we've done nothing to the house. And now, you know, it's worth, what can I tell you? I don't know, $1 million. And I said to my kids, the only reason that this house is, that, you know, there is this money to it is because of the education and what you got and everything. You don't need the money. So we have will gift on my death, and we're working with them now on doing all sorts of things to prepare for that. We are gifting the property to Princeton Community Housing, that there should be housing for a poor family that's not in a project, but it's just on a street in the middle of town. You don't need a lot of cars. You can walk every place. And my kids don't need it. And hopefully it will be Princeton Community Housing. I think Ed Trusselli is just a wonderful director. So we're working. And we have a little tiny piece of land right next to it, because Harry's Brook runs close by. And they have promised that they will build a small house of like two bedrooms or something. And so they're going through all of the papers now and are getting all of the approvals, and everything is being done. And it's just wonderful to work with them and to know that there will be two families that will be able to just, you know,
have a life.
Yeah. Now, I also know that nonetheless, if you live in the village or you live in these other places, again, there's a community. There are people there together. It's a balance. It's not so great only being by yourself, but there are options and people can choose. So we said, that's it. We have put nothing into Princeton except that $20,000 to build that living room. You know, and to walk away with all this other money, you know, it seems ridiculous. The one thing about Princeton that I have to say, and that's the entire community, is that our daughter was born here. She was born in Princeton Hospital on Witherspoon Street and was educated in all the Princeton schools and went through the high school. And she went to the Jewish Center and became a bat mitzvah and all. And she was a kid who was, maybe because she was involved in Habonim Dror, the Labor Zionist group, she had a lot of values, even as a young kid. She was called a tree hugger, which they don't describe people that way these days. But she also spent a year in Israel on a kibbutz and came home and really was concerned about how people are treated and at that time also there was a refugee from a Latin American country that the U.S. was almost at war with. I don't know why what the problem was, but it was Honduras or something. And Amy was at Rutgers, and she was going to bring this guy to Rutgers to talk and support, refugees and that sort of thing. And so she had a lot of values and was very active in things. And so when she died at age 20 from an aneurysm, what do you do? I just knew that my job was to hold together a family of four. Four was a very uneven number. You can sit on a chair and think it's balanced. Let me tell you, five is better than four. Yeah, a family of five. And so my job was to make sure that that our family stayed together as a family. And she was wonderful. She was energetic and bubbly and loved people. And she was her father's daughter, what can I tell you? Everybody who knew her loved her. And when she died, like that, I got a call from Middlesex County Hospital, now known as Robert Wood Johnson, because she was at Rutgers, that they wanted permission to treat her, because I said, she's 20 years old. What are you talking about? What are you treating her for? Why do you? And they said, she's in a coma, and we don't think she will come out of the coma. I mean, no warning at all. Well, and then she died. We went down. Dan and Joel were living each nearby. We went down, and they wanted permission to harvest her organs. And we said, yes, the heart, the lungs, the kidneys, whatever you want. And Dan said, don't touch her face. Everything else, skin, whatever you want, but don't touch her face. And so they harvested organs, and she was... we had the funeral the day after, and then she was buried. And the rabbi, whose name I can't remember, was wonderful because the funeral was on a Friday. She was buried out on, out in Long Island near Kennedy Airport, in what I call a shtetl cemetery. All the stones are right up next to each other. And she's buried next to the great-grandmother that she was named after, and where Mel's parents were buried, and later Mel was buried, and there's one spot left for me in the old Montefiore Cemetery. But so to leave the Jewish Center, the funeral was at the Jewish Center on Friday, maybe 11, ended maybe 12:30, to get out there and the burial and all of her friends from Habonim, from Princeton, and so many people. And I said to the rabbi, this was November, so it got dark very early. I said, I'm really sorry that you're going to have to travel during on Shabbat to get home. And he lied to me. And he said, oh, no, as long as you've started on the journey, it's okay, don't worry. And I thought to myself, thank you. He didn't want me to feel guilty. That was not important. But what happened was, I mean, it was such a shock to everybody. And if you have a kid of your own and you think, how could this happen? I mean, she wasn't on drugs. She wasn't in an accident. It wasn't that she was sick for a long time. And it was just within a moment. And so people started sending money to the Jewish Center in her memory. And money poured in. And the Jewish Center board they said, we're holding this money in trust for you until you decide what you want to do with it. We are not, this is not money for the Jewish Center. I mean, it was just amazing. And so we decided somehow, I don't know how, somehow, that in order to keep her alive and her values ongoing, that we were going to use that money and any monies that came in, and we were going to give grants to young people, you know, like who finished high school, maybe finished college, who wanted to study and to work and to do social action. And not just what she was interested in, because things change and you don't know, but it's anything of that sort that she would have done. And we sold stock that we had in the company where Mel worked. And we got a lawyer and we set it up as a 501c3. So all monies would go directly to grantees and all administrative costs we cover. And it's now been 36 years since she's died, and we've given out something like 1,600 grants and to all over the world. I mean, we're talking Africa, we're talking East Asia, we're talking Latin America, Israel, Palestine, and of course in the U.S., and they're just wonderful things that these kids have done under supervision. They're learning how to do it. And then they come back and they do things that are really... So that's wonderful. But we said, we have to thank this community for what they have done for us. And so we have an annual lecture. And except for during COVID, so... At the end of this month, we're having our 33rd annual lecture. And it's our gift to the community. No cost. You know, people have to register because a lot of people come, and I want to make sure that it's a smooth, people get in smoothly and there's no, you know, ta-ra-ra about, you know, get out of my way, I'm going in and you can't. But it's so when people say to me, when they hear about her dying, and they say, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. I say, no, she's still alive. Her soul is here. Her values are ongoing. She is alive. And when I told my sons this September, past September, that it's getting hard for me. I'm 89, you know. Give me a break. It's time to maybe we'll just keep on with the annual lecture, but not give out grants, and we'll tell people that after this. And they were said, oh, but it's our sister, you know, why don't you get more help? But Mom, you do what you have to do. So I said, okay, then I think we'll stop it at the end of this. So that was September. In October, I get an envelope, a thick FedEx envelope from South Carolina. I know no one in South Carolina. I've never known anyone who lived in South Carolina. And I open it up, and it's a letter from an attorney who says he had a client who has died, and but she left in her will, she left a bequest to the Amy Edina Shulman Memorial Fund. And he gives me her name. I've never heard of her. She's not on our mailing list. Nobody in the family knows her. Nobody who I've spoken to knows. And I said, tell me about her. Well, she was an elderly woman, and her partner had died a few years ago, and she died, and she was leaving money to various groups. And next year, I would get a check, probably a little larger, after they paid all the legal fees. The check was $16,000. That's money. 3 weeks later, I went to a wedding in Philadelphia. And I knew the bride, and I knew her parents, and I knew the couple that drove me there from Princeton, who were also invited. And I didn't know 90 other people. And I sat at a table after the wedding, and the table filled up with people I didn't know, and there was a woman sitting next to me. And I introduced myself, and she introduced herself, and she was young like you. And I said, do you work, or, you know, what do you do? And she was involved. She's involved in the head of some environmental group for New York City. And I said, wow, that's really very impressive. We need that desperately. And I said, you know, and I have a memorial fund where we give out grants, and some of the grantees do environmental work. And she said, oh, what's the name of your fund? And I said, well, it's in memory of my daughter. It's the Amy Adina Shulman Memorial Fund. And she looks at me and straightens up, and she says, you gave my daughter a grant 8 years ago. And she turns to her husband and says, Steve, this is Ruth Shulman. She heads that fund that gave a grant to our daughter 8 years ago. And then she takes out her cell phone and she's like, she shows me the letter we sent to her daughter 8 years ago, telling her that she was getting a grant. So I said to the kids, all right, I don't know whether I believe this or not, but God is talking to me. I can't stop the fund. You don't know what it's doing out there. You know you're giving grants and they write back and what wonderful times they had and how important it was, but you don't know how important it is. Gotta keep it going.
You started this interview talking about moving to Princeton and looking for a community, and you've certainly brought us to the most sort of wonderful descriptive sense of community that one could imagine.
And
thank you for that. So it's been an hour. Do you have a favorite Princeton story you want to tell us? Or you've already told us an amazing story altogether. I'm going to give you a chance to say anything else you'd like.
Well, I just didn't talk about the one thing that really was so important in my life, and that is my 25 years working at Rutgers. It has nothing to do with Princeton except that I could get there. By that time, I had a car. And I had to buy a shiftless car because people in New Jersey didn't know how to drive in the snow. And I thought, oh, my God. So I bought myself a shiftless car, and for 25 years, wonderful years. That's another community. You have to build communities wherever you are. And that's what I tell my sons. You have friends all over the world, but you have to have a community. That's what keeps us together. And we have to build strong communities. And we have to make Princeton stronger for everybody. And that's very important because we all have, life is very difficult. Life is, we don't appreciate it enough, but there are the traumas in life. And we all have to have community where we help each other get through that. And Princeton has been that, Rutgers was that, my daughter built that, my sons have that. And to me, that gives me hope for the future. Otherwise, I don't know. I don't know how you survive if you don't have hope for the future. And we have to build bridges for each other.
Thank you, Ruth.
Okay.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.